And good afternoon. It is 12:02 Friday afternoon, a beautiful day, a little windy. It's going to get cold, as you just heard, but enjoy it while you can, what's left of the warm weather. Being Friday, of course, our guest is Jeb Bradley, Senate Majority Leader and Wolfboro resident. Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon, Eric. How are you?
I am very well. I'm just curious because Jack never asked you. I thought he would have. Well, did you watch the Super Bowl? What did you think?
Yeah, it was a great game. I thought it, it was very evenly matched. I thought both teams had good game plans. I wasn't really rooting specifically for either team. Matthew Stafford, the Detroit, now L.A. quarterback, had a long and difficult career, in that he was a great quarterback, but never had, any pieces around him to make that team good. So he was traded to L.A., put on a good team. So I was kind of rooting for him, and Joe Burrow, the Cincinnati quarterback, obviously an up and coming, stud. Really, I think we'll have many chances to win Super Bowls, which, may not be great for Patriot fans, but, we have a young gun too. And hopefully, we're going to be very competitive next year. But I thought it was a good game. And I thought that, L.A. overcame the loss of Odell Beckham, which really changed how Cincinnati defended against the pass and to bottle up the run. And, it was a close game, but L.A. was able to pull it off.
All right. Before we go on to our next question, I just want to welcome Brody Deshaies is with us, so a Wolfboro resident and state representative. Brody, how you doing, man?
I'm well. How are you, Eric?
I am very well. Thank you.
Out
of curiosity, what did either of you think of the halftime show? It wasn't my cup of tea, but I know a lot of people loved it.
You know what? I was up and doing something during halftime. I can't even remember what it was, but I didn't see much of it.
Brody, did you watch the halftime show?
So I did not watch the Super Bowl till the end of the fourth quarter. I tried to refrain because the Patriots were not in it.
I understand.
But I caved because I saw that it was a close score. So I said, I guess I'll watch it. And it was a good end.
All right, Senator, I know that you talked a little bit about this with Jack, but I know you only had a few minutes. Obviously, you heard the governor's state of the state yesterday. Your thoughts, your opinions?
I mean, both Brody and I were there, and I think, Brody should weigh in too. But Governor Sununu has done an excellent job overall, and he outlined the successes that New Hampshire has had under his leadership and, that of Senator Morse, who's now running for U.S. Senate, and also Speaker Packard. I mean, we passed a good budget that continued to provide more incentives for businesses to locate here, and that's driving the economy. No question about it. Our revenues are off the chart strong, and unless we have a national recession, we'll continue to be. And we rank at the top of so many different areas in this country. I mean, we're one of the most livable states in the United States. We're the safest state. We have the lowest poverty rate. We have among the lowest unemployment rate. We have among the best job opportunities, fastest growing economy in the Northeast, freest state in the nation. By different rankings. So, Governor Sununu, rightfully so, was taking credit for it because he's been the governor as we've achieved this, and he's really led on, these issues, along with, Chuck Morse, who's the Senate president. And at the same time, I think the governor also identified a couple of areas, where we are in the process of making improvements. Mental health. It's been, a 6-year initiative to upgrade our mental health system. Now we're using some of the federal resources to buy the Hampstead Hospital, which is going to have facilities for kids, which has been a real problem, especially during the pandemic as the mental health crisis grew and grew and grew. We're trying to use some of these same federal funds to create a mental health hospital run by Healthcare Corporation of America, which is the Portsmouth and Derry Hospital. They want to build a facility in Epping, and this would provide a little bit of capital infrastructure for them. Hopefully that gets through the executive council. And he talked about affordable housing, and we put a lot of resources into the Affordable Housing Fund, but hopefully using some of the federal ARPA money that we have at our disposal now, we can jumpstart and actually build some housing. And I think, you know, so the governor took a bow for, you know, the great work he's done on a whole range of issues, but also identified where, you know, we need to go and what we need to do. And I think those are, you know, two big things. So,
all right, Brody, would you like to weigh in? What did you think of the speech?
I thought it was great. I thought it was very forward-thinking. I thought it was a good change of pace compared to what's going on in Washington. That in New Hampshire, you know, the governor kept saying the term innovative, right? And that's what we are in New Hampshire, right? We're Granite Staters. We're innovative. We think of unique ways to solve complex problems. We develop better systems than what they have in Washington. So whether it's with school choice and the education freedom accounts, whether it's with, you know, the housing problem that we've had and trying to incentivize public-private partnerships, or, you know, with bail reform, right? The governor mentioned Senator Bradley and I's SB 294, which he wants to, you know, he said directly he wants it on his desk as soon as possible. So, I mean, we have a lot of great things to look forward to. We have great revenues coming in because of the strong business climate that we've created with the recent budget we passed and the tax reductions. We delivered real property tax relief, which the governor mentioned. I mean, there was a myriad of things the governor mentioned that we've done that are very positive for Granite Staters that are going to, you know, create a better future for everyone. And there are things we're going to do to improve upon that. And so, I mean, that's the biggest thing. It was, you know, we're on the up and up here in the Granite State with, you know, freest state in the nation, according to the Cato Institute, lowest unemployment rate in the nation, lowest poverty rate in the region. So, you know, we have a lot of great things to be proud of here in the Granite State. He had a lot of great things to discuss that he's worked for the last, you know, now since he was first elected in 2016. And, you know, it's going to be no different in 2022, and it's going to be no different when he gets reelected in 2022, that we're going to have a lot of great things to build upon, and a lot of great things to look forward to, and a lot of great goals for us to accomplish moving forward.
All right, Senator, Brody had just mentioned very briefly educational freedom accounts, and there are a couple of bills here that I've been looking at. Senate Bill 432, which appears to have been inexpedient to legislate. Some people have called that an attack on charter schools. I'm not sure I know enough to render an opinion, but I'm sure you do.
So, look, we have a pretty good public education system in New Hampshire. It's not without its faults, but overall I think it's pretty good. But, mm-hmm. you know, when you have almost, I think it's 180,000 students in New Hampshire, you're going to find that not every kid thrives in the public schools. And increasingly, I think parents and their children are looking for different options for some kids that just need, you know, something different. I know from firsthand experience. My three sons all graduated from Kingswood. It was great for them. My daughter needed something different, and thankfully I was able to provide that for her. So we passed legislation last year that was folded into the budget that created education savings accounts so that the state portion of education dollars can follow the child in whatever, you know, whether it's homeschooling or some sort of private school or tutoring even, so that they get the best educational opportunities possible. 1,800 kids have taken advantage of that. only 204 have left the public school as of yet. And so the big argument was, well, why are we helping, you know, these 1,600 other kids? Well, guess what? They're taxpayers too. And why shouldn't they, especially since we targeted parents of more modest means and their kids, why shouldn't they be able to take advantage, you know, of the same kind of scholarship? And it's not impacting public schools because we created transition grants. So as students left, schools would still get the same amount of adequacy dollars for the next 3 years. So I think, as I was quoted in the papers afterwards, I think it's been a smashing success. And when we had hearings, there were any number of kids that came in and told us that this was really important for their education, their development, their ability, you know, to be able to become the people that they want to be. And education should be one of our absolute top priorities. And, you know, people say, well, you're shortchanging public education. And no, we're not. In the 2019 budget, we put $140 million of new dollars into education funding. In the budget that, you know, just recently passed in June, that Brody and I both supported, worked for, another $102 million went for increased education aid. That's almost $250 million over the last, you know, 4 years. That's really significant. And my colleague, Senator Aaron Hennessy, has a bill this year that I hope that we're able to pass and pass to the House, and they see fit to do the same, that will dedicate, I think it's about another $30 million to education funding. When we're running the kind of surpluses we're running, I think that that money should be used, you know, to try to fund education. We've had these long-term lawsuits, and we're doing that, and it's appropriate to do that. But at the same time, let's not jam kids into a one-size-fits-all, you know, solution for them, and let's give them choices and opportunities. And unfortunately, my friends on the other side of the aisle, you know, reject that approach, and it's, you know, their approach is one-size-fits-all, every kid has to go to the same school, and there can't be any options. Well, in the 21st century, I don't think that works all that well, and kids need choices. That's just the way I think life works, and it's been especially true what we've seen during the pandemic. So I'm thrilled that, you know, the Senate rejected the repeal of education savings accounts. It was a partisan vote, but it was the right vote, and I think you should not be pulling the plug on these 1,800 kids that are, you know, of modest means, and that's where they're targeted for some sort of political agenda that says, no, they don't deserve their choice.
What are some of the talking points that the people opposed to this bill are trying to justify it with? I don't understand why a student should be corralled, as you say, into one form of education.
So what they're trying to say is, well, we undermine public education, all right? That's their biggest talking point. But that's why I went through the figures of, you know, what we have dedicated over the last two budgets to increase education dollars for public education. It's been significant. And at the same time, you know, we've authorized these education savings accounts, which have been popular, and we have enough money, even though they're somewhat oversubscribed in the first year, to pay for it because, you know, the Education Trust Fund is solid financially because we're running large surpluses, and that goes back to economic growth. And so if you want to, you know, at least in my opinion, Eric, if you want to solve problems that we have, you know, in New Hampshire, whether it's mental health or substance abuse, both of which need, you know, increased resources, or water infrastructure or broadband infrastructure, you need a growing economy to be able to have the resources to tackle problems. And that's what, you know, Brody and I, along with, you know, Governor Sununu, Senator Morse, et cetera, have worked for. And I think the proof's in the pudding. We have these resources to be able to put more money into public education. That's a good thing. But at the same time, give kids the choices that they need. So the talking points, you know, of our friends on the other side of the aisle, I think just don't add up.
Okay.
You know, this is like exactly the same argument that was made when we first lowered business taxes 6 years ago.
And that was you're undermining the system?
Governor Hassan made this huge statement. You're blowing a $90 million hole in the budget. Okay? This was in 2015 when we first began to lower business taxes. All right? Well, that was proven totally incorrect. Every year, I think except one during the pandemic, business taxes came in over expectations. Now they're hugely over expectations, which is why we're running, you know, such big surpluses. And why is that? We made New Hampshire more competitive. We had been among the absolute worst in the nation in terms of high business taxes. We have, you know, made steady progress, and we're now approaching, you know, somewhat more in the middle. Still a problem, but we're getting there, and we're getting much more competitive. So what happened? Businesses said, hey, New Hampshire's attractive. We also passed workers' compensation reform. So two of the big cost drivers for businesses, we have made substantial progress on. Business located here, they hired people, there was much more economic activity overall in New Hampshire. Guess what? A lot more revenue. That's the way, you know, to produce revenue, not to, you know, raise taxes, whether it's on businesses or, as you know, a lot of our friends on the other side of the aisle want, a sales tax, an income tax, a capital gains tax. You know, the way to raise revenue is to grow the economy, and we've proven that year after year.
You know, it's funny. There's a have you ever heard of the video game called The Sims?
You know, Eric, I am 70 years old almost. I'll be there in a few months. I have a head full of white hair. I'm not up to date on video games.
All right. Well, this one actually goes back quite a ways, but the reason I mention it is you are the mayor of this city, and you build, you know, commercial zones and industrial zones and residential zones, and you set tax rates. And I've noticed that once you get to a certain figure in the game, which is usually about a 10,000 people population, cutting taxes actually increases revenue. They figured that into the algorithm. And it was fascinating.
When I was a member of Congress in, I think it was 2003, we passed a big tax reform initiative. And one of the things it did was lower the rate on capital gains. And you know what happened? Revenue exploded to the federal treasury. Why? Because instead of paying 28%, which I think was the rate then, and it went down to the current rate of 20%, people made the choice of taking long-term investments and, you know, investments that they didn't want to pay a 28% capital gains tax, and they were somewhat passive about and just sort of riding it out because they didn't want to pay the tax. They took it, they sold, they invested, the economy grew, and the revenue exploded. That's what happens when you have a growing economy. And it really, you know, this is what Washington should be looking at, as opposed to all this spending that, you know, we really have driven our deficit up over $30 trillion. It is inflationary, and, you know, it's having a result, and it's going to be a drag on the economy. And that's why, again, to get back to what, you know, Governor Sununu was talking about yesterday, the contrast between New Hampshire and Washington can't be greater. That's why, you know, my good friend Chuck Morse is running for U.S. Senate, to bring that kind of common sense approach to Washington. He's a business guy. He's run a successful nursery for years. He understands, you know, the pressures that small businesses are under. He understands how to balance a budget. He's done that for years in New Hampshire with his own business. and, you know, as the architect of a number of the New Hampshire budgets. So, you know, the contrast couldn't be clearer.
Okay. It's 1222 on WASR. My guest today, Jeb Bradley, Senate Majority Leader, and State Representative Brody DeShays, both of Wolfboro. Let's start talking about a local problem, SB 249, the short-term rental bill. I understand that has advanced.
Yes, it's passed the Senate, passed on a voice vote, and it now will go to the House. So, you know, Brody will get a chance to weigh in on it there. But let me just say this. Given all the litigation that we've had for a number of years around short-term rentals, I have felt for the last 3 or 4 years we needed a reasonable and rational compromise on short-term rentals rather than just, you know, hard and fast banning of them or what we have today, which is, you know, no regulations and anything goes, and you have, you know, not many but certainly enough, you know, noisy, overutilized properties in places like the Mount Washington Valley that have led to disruptions of the neighborhood. And so the bill the Senate passed the other day gives towns a lot of new authorities to regulate all municipal ordinances on short-term rentals, and if they're violations of, for instance, health, safety, sanitation, parking, noise, and other municipal ordinances, a short-term rental can be required to register, and if they violate these ordinances, the registration can be pulled. And I think that will enforce the better behavior that we want to see and not have these party houses, because it will force the owner to be on top of the situation as opposed to just letting it ride. And I think, you know, that'll provide a dramatic improvement. I understand towns don't appreciate, you know, the fact that we would say you just can't have an outright ban on them. I get that. My argument is that, especially in areas of the state like the Seacoast, the Lakes region, the Mount Washington Valley, the mountains, tourism is really important. It's one of the biggest industries in our state. And if we undermine this new form of tourism where families are trying to rent, you know, houses so that their kids or possibly the grandparents can vacation together, people are going to go to other states, and it will, you know, it will undermine our attractiveness. So I think we can solve the problems of short-term rentals, you know, without eliminating them. And, you know, we'll see how it does in the House. But that's sort of where I, you know, came down on it, especially after the decision in the Carroll County Superior Court, where the judge, first of all, said there has to be a legislative solution, and then she ruled against the town of Conway. And to me, that made it even more important that we pass a compromise, which I think Senate Bill 249, you know, seeks to get to.
The only problem I see with it is local towns that may want to, it almost looks like it could set up a backdoor ban by setting up a whole bunch of red tape to get through, as you said, with sanitation and noise and safety. I mean, who defines noise? It seems to me.
Well, a town has a noise ordinance, Eric.
Okay.
Every town has to adopt their own noise ordinance. So if you're, you know, partying all night and loud music or whatever, that's probably in violation of a noise ordinance. Or if you're, you know, up at 5:30 a.m. with a chainsaw or a lawnmower, again, same type of thing. And you can be, you know, visited by law enforcement if you're in violation of the noise ordinance. And if you have, you know, a second violation of the way this is written, the registration for a short-term rental can be pulled, and the owner then can't use it as a short-term rental. So there's no more rigmarole than would currently exist for any other rental, you know, whether it's a long-term rental or an owner-occupied house. But it would give a town the authority to, you know, create a real disincentive against, you know, an owner that doesn't screen his or her tenants properly and enforce good behavior, you know, no loud noises, no parking all over the place. Another thing that's really important is, you know, if you have a four-bedroom house, you shouldn't have 24 people sleeping there. You know, those are safety and sanitation type regulations. So I think, you know, there was broad support for that part of the bill. I think where it became a bit more contentious is on saying you can't have an outright ban on them on a town level.
Are they subject to the rooms and meals tax?
Yes. And the testimony in front of the Senate Commerce Committee is that one of the platforms, I can't remember which one, either Airbnb or HomeAway, their information is publicly disclosed for some reason, that through that one platform, which represents about 40% of the market in New Hampshire of, you know, the online Airbnb type things, they brought in $9 million for the rooms and meals tax. So at 40%, the estimate is it's somewhere between $20 and $25 million, likely to grow. And let's also remember that 30% of all rooms and meals tax revenue goes back to towns now under the budget that, you know, Brody and I passed. So, you know, it's a pretty significant source of revenue for the state of New Hampshire and for cities and towns across our state.
Yeah, it's also, you know, it's very good for the economy in general. The more people here, the more money they spend. It makes perfect sense. Brody, in the House, I know you'd need a bit of a crystal ball, but what do you think about this STR bill?
It can be, I mean, currently I think as the amended version goes, it does return a lot of control to communities in the original language that the bill provided for. And one example is the definition of what a short-term rental is, right? The definition is a little bit more precise. It says directly in the amendment, you know, in the current bill now, quote, nothing in this paragraph shall limit a municipality's existing authority to generally regulate parking, noise, safety, health, sanitation, or other related municipal ordinances under duly adopted ordinances and regulations authorized under state law. So it doesn't prevent communities from regulating short-term rentals as they do anything else. It also said directly that a municipality can establish a reasonable fee to cover the cost of the town or city clerk of maintaining a record of the filings to keep track of where short-term rentals are in a community. And it allows municipalities to adopt, quote, to adopt an ordinance which requires an inspection of the property to determine if the property meets the minimum housing standards of, you know, RSA 48-A:14, or fire warning device and carbon monoxide detection device as required in RSA 153:10-A:2. So, and another thing too is it says the municipality may establish a reasonable fee to cover all the costs. So it's even more precise. Not only a reasonable fee can be established, but it needs to be reasonable, but to cover all the costs of the municipality conducting these inspections. And the other thing too, so essentially what the bill does now is it allows local communities to regulate these short-term rentals to ensure that they're safe and habitations for people to rent, to ensure that they're on, that they can be in areas that are acceptable to the public, that are okay with the noise and health and a number of other things. But what it prevents is an outright ban. And as Senator Bradley mentioned, right, these outright bans are just going to create a bunch of litigation. We live in such a litigious society today. It's going to create a bunch of litigation. And the Conway decision that recently came out that I know a lot of Lakes Region towns have been looking at, what came out in Conway in that court decision, Superior Court decision, was essentially a request for the state to handle how these communities are going to be able to regulate them. And I think this bill, by working with the municipal and you know, the municipalities and the counties and everything, and to really strike a good deal to figure out how are we going to make it so then towns can still regulate these short-term rentals, right, but prevent towns from putting over-stringent regulations on the private property owners who should be able to use their property in a myriad of ways that are safe okay with how, you know, people have used their properties for, you know, nearly a decade now. And so it's just trying to strike that balance so then communities can have some control over where these short-term rentals are, or, you know, how people are utilizing short-term rentals and everything and how it affects the community at large, but also just prevent any community from kind of punting, if you will, and saying, we don't want any short-term rentals and we don't want anyone to have any participation in short-term rentals when, you know, there's a lot of circumstances. The vast majority of short-term rentals are in seasonal homes. They don't affect the general public. They don't affect the health. They tend to be used, you know, in a very quiet and respectful manner. A lot of people may not even realize that there's a short-term rental, you know, in their area. Maybe if it's on a small pond or lake, you know, on an acre of land, right? So what we're trying to do is make it so then these short-term rentals are being used responsibly, that the communities can ensure that they're, you know, enforcing that responsible use, but that no community decides to ban all of them, because that's just a knee-jerk reaction, and it's not fair to private property owners and to summer tourists who, quite frankly, I mean, when you consider, too, New Hampshire's economy, especially Wolfboro and Conway, we're very dependent on these summer tourists. And if short-term rentals are helping fulfill a need to bring these summer tourists in, then, you know, we should be allowing some of these short-term rentals to be reasonably used and meeting the same regulations as a number of our local inns and beds and breakfasts.
Okay. 12:33 on WASR. Senator, I noticed your bail reform bill advanced, Senate Bill 294.
Yeah, I was very pleased. We had, you know, a good debate. 20 of my colleagues voted for it. Well, 19 plus myself, and only four against. So I think it's moving in the right direction. Last year, the same bill was 17-7. So, you know, as we've said a number of times, Brody and I on your show, Eric, you know, given the problems that we've seen in other states, to say nothing of problems that have happened in New Hampshire, I think that when there's an allegation of a violent crime, somebody, should have to go before a judge before they're automatically bailed, because too many times it just leads to another violent crime. And we have crime waves across the country, and this revolving door of, you know, people committing crime, getting, you know, bail, getting out, committing again, has been really problematic. And I think the, you know, New Hampshire Chiefs of Police Association did a good job of highlighting some of the, you know, very real problems that we've had. So I hope that this time, you know, Brody's able to be successful in the House. I talked yesterday to the chair of the committee that is likely to hear the bill, Daryl Abbas, and I think he feels, you know, somewhat more optimistic, but all I can say is we'll see what happens.
Well, a 20-4 vote, you know, bodes well, at least in the Senate. Assuming it breaks that way, you know, it should pass. But, you know, it's politics. You never know what happens until it happens.
Yeah, the governor spoke about that bill, you know, yesterday. He's obviously very concerned about, you know, crime wave in other states. We are the safest state in the nation, and, you know, I think it's for a number of different reasons, but our laws are good. We haven't defunded the police. Some people, a small number of people have, you know, probably tried to do that, but the vast majority of people across the political spectrum don't agree in New Hampshire with defunding the police, and our laws are better than they are in other states, and we also protect people's rights under the Second Amendment to be able to defend their lives and their property. So I think for all these reasons, we are a safe state, but there have been enough examples of the failure of so-called bail reform a few years ago that was not supposed to let violent criminals out automatically. And that's what we're trying to correct. And it's really only the most egregious of crimes, you know, from murder down to domestic violence. And some people would say, well, some domestic violence is treated as a misdemeanor. Yes. Well, that's true. At the same time, domestic violence situations can escalate rapidly and to very dire consequences. So, again, the fact that if you're a threat to yourself or a threat to others, potentially after committing a violent crime, and yes, I know you haven't been found guilty by, you know, a jury of your peers, and there's always the innocent until proven guilty protections that we have under our Constitution. But at the same time, you know, this is a surgical attempt to say you have to see a judge if you've committed one of these 13, you know, crimes that are pretty violent in nature. And I think it's the right thing to do. And you know what? The proof, again, is in the pudding, because whether it's in New Hampshire or other states, we've seen what happens when people get out.
How long do you think it'll take to pass the House?
Well, hopefully it'll pass in the next 2 or 3 months. I mean, you know, the House is dealing with their bills, the House bills. We're still dealing with the Senate bills. But by the end of March, the House should have all the Senate bills. We'll have all the House bills. And so hopefully, you know, April or May timeframe, we'll, you know what's going to happen. I think, you know, Brody's in a great position to be able to advocate for this bill.
Brody, yeah, you support this bill as well.
Let me just double check. Which bill are we talking about again? It was kind of tough to hear the language.
Senate Bill 294.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, 100%. That's the bail reform bill. 100%.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. No, I'll be calling a roll call in the House. I'd like to encourage all my my House colleagues to be on board to ensure that we're protecting the victims of violent crimes from their former perpetrators, making sure that people who have committed violent crimes are being that they're being held, and that, you know, that we ensure that they're away from society until they have their trial and everything, if they can't produce evidence that they can be safely let back out into society. I mean, this is it's a huge issue that we've seen across the country, you know, the rise in crimes and everything. And it's an issue we saw with our bail reform in this state, where there were certain criminals who were being let back into the public on PR bail, who were, quite frankly, they shouldn't have been let back out. But we had a system that was designated more towards being soft on crime and less being worried about victims and what's safe for them. And at the end of the day, a justice system needs to be just. It needs to be righteous. And there's nothing just or righteous in letting someone out of custody so they can go back and abuse the same victim that they were previously abusing. That's not right. Justice needs to be just, and that means making sure that everyone is safe in a society.
Okay. A little earlier, Senator, you had mentioned that HCA is building a mental hospital in Epping. They're a for-profit company, but yet the state is giving them the $12 million in capital costs. The libertarian in me looks at that with a bit of a side eye. Are we getting something in particular for that, or is that an incentive for HCA to build the hospital?
Yeah, it's an incentive for them to build the hospital. You know, I think that we have a bed shortage. It's widely documented. We've had a bed shortage for several years. That's why people are oftentimes just held in emergency rooms until a bed becomes available. And so, you know, this will make the numbers work for HCA in a way that we'll get the beds that we need at a rate that is sustainable, and they'll have the capital costs the rate that they can move forward with and, you know, provide the services that we need. So I think it's a win-win, and it's, you know, one more thing that, you know, we need to do, because the mental health crisis hasn't gone away. And, you know, it's cousin, the fentanyl crisis, the drug crisis is, you know, still with us. While we're making some progress on that score, you know, the open border, you know, in the southern part of the United States, drugs are pouring across that border, and a lot of it is fentanyl, and it's still widely available, and it's a problem. So we need to have the resources to deal with it.
Yeah, there was a guy from Senator Ossipee who just got, what is it, 20-something years for having a whole bunch of fentanyl. It was a federal issue. Something else.
Yeah, I mean, fentanyl is deadly. And, you know, it's just, it's a problem. And, you know, again, it's sort of part and parcel of our very weak foreign policy. You know, it's manufactured in China, smuggled across an open border, you know, between Mexico, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas and California. And you know, it's just too easy. And it's wrong. And, you know, but we're left with having to pick up the pieces. And, you know, that drug crisis and mental health crisis, it just continues to need resources.
Yeah, it does. It's 12:43. We're talking with Jeff Bradley and Brody DeShays here on WASR. This is one of those bills that you do the, oh, you hit yourself in the head and said, I could have had a V8. Because it's so common sense that nobody thought of it. Senate Bill 234, which requires school IDs to have the National Suicide Prevention Hotline on them. What a fantastic idea that is. I mean, have you seen that bill, Senator?
You know, I don't have internet access right now because of all the wind.
But
thankfully, and if you could tell me what happened to it, that would be helpful. Maybe Brody can look it up if he has internet.
Yeah, can you do that? Can you follow that? I haven't seen... I wasn't able to find out where that bill is, but it seems such a fantastic idea that it, you know, in my opinion, it's kind of a no-brainer, but I'm sure there's somebody who doesn't like it. If we could look into that in the meantime, we'll move on a little bit to abortion. As you know, things are heating up nationally. Florida has introduced their own bill. Texas, of course, as you know, has the most restrictive bill at the moment. But there's a constitutional amendment here in New Hampshire to try and enshrine rights to abortion, as well as a House bill, as I understand it, as well. We've already reformed the abortion laws just quite recently, if I remember properly. What further modification do you think needs to be done to the existing law?
Well, the Senate has passed, you know, changes to the late-term abortion ban that was passed last spring.
Right.
And if you recall, there was discrepancy between the language in one part and another part that required an ultrasound prior to any abortion.
Mm-hmm.
So the Senate has fixed that. An ultrasound would be required if there was a prospect of an abortion around 24 weeks or viability, which is what the standard for late-term abortion is. And I think that it's, you know, the public agrees that we should not have late-term abortion for, you know, in the 7th, 8th, 9th month or right up until the moment of birth. And, you know, that's been my position. The second bill that is on the table in the Senate would have put into law pre-viability allowances in New Hampshire for abortion. Currently, there's no prohibition on it, so I think some people would argue it's not necessary. But I actually voted against killing that bill. I would have voted, you know, to pass the bill had that motion been available, but it was a 12-12 vote, so we put it on the table. I don't think that's likely to go anywhere at this point in time. We'll just have to wait and see, you know, what the U.S. Supreme Court does in the Mississippi case. You know, but I continue to be pro-choice. but I don't support late-term abortion.
No, I understand that. There's a related House bill with that one, Brody, if you're looking things up, House Bill 1674. Anyway, let's move on.
You mean House Bill 1673?
Oh, pardon me. I must have written it down wrong.
I could be mistaken, though. I did look up that that other bill.
Senate Bill 234?
Yeah, that passed the Senate with an amendment. That was Senator Ruth Ward's legislation. So I'm not sure if it was on the consent calendar or not, but it did pass the Senate, so it's going to come over to the House. And I assume the House will pass it.
It probably
Eric,
was
so you'll
on
probably,
the consent calendar
you will,
because I don't
You will get your way, Eric. We probably will end up passing that bill.
Good. I'm glad. Now, this constitutional amendment, and you have to forgive me because I slept through civics class. What is required to amend the New Hampshire Constitution? I know it's different, a little different from the federal Constitution.
So, to amend the New Hampshire Constitution, it has to be placed on the ballot by the legislature. So you need a 60% majority of people present and voting. So that means about 240 members of the House and 15 senators. If both bodies pass it and put it on the ballot, then it needs a two-thirds vote of the voters in the fall general election. And that amends the Constitution. And it is difficult, as it was intended to be by the founders, to amend the Constitution. It needs broad support. The last amendment to the New Hampshire Constitution was the privacy amendment that passed, I believe it was in 2018, that had broad support. I think we are a state that wants to protect individual liberties and the privacy that goes with them. And that, you know, went through the process, got the necessary legislative support, and then it was passed by the voters.
Okay, next one is House Bill 1624, and it says FNA, which is what, fiscal note? Or Brody, can you help me out with this one?
This is House Bill what?
1624, FNA.
1624. Well, that means we probably, if it's House Bill, that means we probably acted on it already, unless it was a,
well, that's what I was reading about it.
Disability, yep. Participating in co-curricular activities and making appropriation thereof.
Yes, that's the one. What, can you define what a unified co-curricular activity is?
I cannot define it.
Okay.
But I tell you this, I can tell you the New Hampshire House passed it on a voice vote, and it's going to finance probably in the next few weeks. So it was passed the committee 15-0.
Oh, well, that's impressive.
So that I can tell you. What exactly, it only costs, it seems it'll cost the state $50,000 a year, but it brings in $50,000 worth of revenue. So it's an offsetting kind of cost. So it's probably going to make it through finance fairly easily. I'm just not entirely sure what the legislation does. I know the prime sponsor, though. I know one of the co-sponsors, Senator Bradley. So maybe Senator Bradley can comment as to what it does.
Senator?
You know what? Again, I'd have to see it in front of me. And unfortunately, as I said before, I only have internet access on my phone. And I'm using it to talk to you, Aaron.
Right. I understand. But what is the FNA part of the bill? Is that, does that stand?
So
it
that
must stand
it
for
has
something.
A fiscal note. Okay. FN stands for fiscal note. That means there's either a cost or a potential cost, and usually it triggers a review by the House and the Senate Finance Committees. And A means a direct appropriation. So as Brody said, there's a $50,000 appropriation.
Okay. There were some public hearings. Let's switch gears again back to the abortion debate. There were some public hearings a couple of weeks ago in the Judiciary Committee on some bills. One of them would eliminate the 25-foot safety zone at abortion clinics. Do either of you want to weigh in on some of those bills and what's happening there?
Yeah, I would just say that, and I supported the 25-foot, you know, corridor so that people, you know, can get in and out of a building. But the United States Supreme Court 7 or 8 years ago, as I recall, on a 9-0 basis, found that to be an unconstitutional violation of First Amendment rights. So while it's on the books in New Hampshire, it's not enforceable.
I didn't know. I had no idea that it's become it was unenforceable.
Yeah.
Okay. So why then is the bill even in process if the Constitution says no, you can't do it?
It just because there was not the wherewithal to repeal it, but it's unenforceable in New Hampshire, so it's not happening.
Okay. On Jack's show a little while ago, Senator, you had mentioned voting, and this is another one of these things that I just don't understand. What's wrong with showing an ID to vote? I mean,
absolutely.
I needed one for my vaccine
nothing.
Booster.
Nothing is wrong. You should have to show an ID to vote. I think the discussion came up because there's a huge national argument led by our Democratic friends in Washington that want to federalize all elections. And I think that's wrong. And as part of that, they would get rid of voter ID laws. And we've had ours in New Hampshire for about 10 years. It's very successful. It's supported by a large majority of people on all sides of the political spectrum, because I think people want to make sure that their vote counts the same as everybody else's, and that people who vote in New Hampshire elections are, you know, who they say they are and entitled to vote in, you know, our elections in New Hampshire. So, you know, that's one thing that this federal legislation would get rid of. And you make the point that you need a identification for virtually, well, for many different things in this country. So one of the most sacred things, voting for, you know, our leaders, it should be, as I said, you know, in the prior interview, we want to make voting in this country as easy as possible, but it's difficult to cheat. And so to me, that means the feds should not be taking over our voting system, which works well in New Hampshire with voter ID, with, voting in person or by absentee ballot that you request, as opposed to mailing everybody a ballot. And who knows how secure those ballots are. That's what the feds want to allow, and that makes it, you know, very easy potentially to cheat. And, you know, you can't argue that it's going to encourage higher turnout, because we have among the highest turnouts in the country with our, you know, current voting system, which is safe and secure and, you know, above reproach. Doesn't mean there haven't been a couple of problems. Windham was an example of a, you know, improperly folded ballots. There were some ballots that were misplaced in Bedford, but that was also largely, I think, a result of the pandemic, and a lot of many, many more people voted by absentee in 2020, and you had fewer well-trained election officials. So, you know, I think that was a one-of type situation, but our elections are well-run. Secretary Gardner, throughout his 44-year illustrious career, did a great job. Dave Scanlon, the new Secretary of State, will continue that tradition. We should, you know, as I said on Jack Heath's show, you know, for the federal government that can't even figure out how to do border security right now, and millions of people are pouring across our southern border, do we want them in charge of our elections in New Hampshire?
Now, when you say federalized, that means a uniform set of federal rules for all elections?
Yeah, no voter ID, mail-in voting to everybody. You'd have ballot harvesting, which means activists can go around and collect ballots, turn them in through unsecure lockbox or drop boxes, I mean. You know, all sorts of avenues for things to happen that shouldn't happen. The reason why people trust the elections in New Hampshire, okay, is that we've done them well for a long period of time. And people ask me, you know, because of all the allegations around the country of potential voter fraud, and I can't speak to what happened in 49 other states. I don't know anything more than what I see on the news, but I can speak to what happened in New Hampshire because I sat through three long recounts. It started at 8 in the morning and lasted till 5 at night. And it was Senate District 11, 12, and 9. And one was decided by 198 votes. One was decided by about 400, the other by about 800. Recounts in all of them. I watched countless ballots, you know, going across the screen. They were illuminated on a screen. They'd sit there for 2 seconds, sometimes 3 seconds, so you could read, you know, the Senate outcome. It was, you know, Kevin Avard against Melanie Levesque was one of them. And so your eye would focus on, is that an Avard ballot or a Levesque ballot? But when you have 2 or 3 seconds for it to be on a screen, you could scan the entire ballot. And as I said on, you know, with Jack Heath, so you look for Avard versus Levesque. You make sure it's, you know, going to go into the right pile. But you could see that a lot of people voted straight Democrat. A lot of people voted straight Republican. But then there were a lot of people that split their ballot. And, you know, many people were on all the federal races, which all the Democrats won, starting with President Biden and Senator Shaheen. And then you got to governor, and it switched from Chris Sununu down on through Republicans, and that happened a lot too. And so the conclusion I came to was, you know, all the Senate races were upheld. There was nothing that changed. The vote totals were pretty similar, you know, after all was said and done. But I walked away understanding that, yeah, you know, Joe Biden won the presidential election in New Hampshire. Not maybe the result I wanted, but that was the result. And I think it gets back to the fact that we run good elections in New Hampshire, and we should continue to do so. We need voter ID, absolutely. We need to have safe and secure elections, but, you know, and I think we've done a good job at making it easy for people to vote. If you need to get an absentee ballot, you request one. You get one. You fill it in. You send it back. It's not a problem. And I think, you know, we should be making sure the people that live in New Hampshire, that are residents of New Hampshire, are the ones that are voting in New Hampshire. And I think we've got a bit of work to do on that. But, you know, that's something that's coming.
Okay, in our last minute or so, Wednesday is All Things Politics with Brody Deshaies coming up at 4 o'clock Wednesday afternoon. And I understand, Senator, you'll be a part of that as well?
Try to. Wednesday's always a busy day because we have session on Thursdays. But if I can, I will.
Okay. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time and opinions. I do appreciate it. Unfortunately, we're out of time.
Well, thank you for having me, Eric.
Thanks, Brody. Thank you, Senator. And we'll talk later.
Bye.
All right. Take care, guys. It is 1 after 1, and the news is next.